Welcome to the Sermon Podcast of Redemption Church. The following sermon is by our Director of Spiritual Formation, Marjorie Mott. Revelation chapters 6 and 7. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, "Come!" I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror, bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come!" And then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make people kill each other. To him was given a large sword. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come!" I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. Then I heard what sounded like a voice coming from the four living creatures saying, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages, and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, and do not damage the oil and the wine." When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, "How long, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer, until the full number of their fellow servants, their brothers and sisters, were killed, just as they had been. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to earth as figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The heavens receded like a scroll being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and everyone else, both slave and free, hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can withstand it?" After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea, "Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of God." And then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." All the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen. Praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders asked me, "These in white robes, who are they and where do they come from?" I answered, "Sir, you know." And he said, "These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat, for the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
All right. What a passage. Oh, it's just so powerful to read out loud and stand together. Thank you for standing with me. When I think of suffering, which is so evident in this passage, I can't help but think of my grandmother. I have the privilege of being named after her, Marjorie. She was Marjorie Jackson. And as a young child, she was actually a prisoner of war. Her parents were missionaries in China, and she was at a boarding school when the Japanese came and overtook her school. This was during World War II. And many of you might know the story of Eric Little. He's the famous gold medalist Olympian who refused to run on a Sunday, right? But maybe what you don't know is that he grew up at that same boarding school, and so as an adult, married with children, when he heard that school was interned, put into this, become prisoner of war, he knew that the leaders, the teachers, were mainly women, just a few Catholic nuns. And so he decided voluntarily to put himself into that camp and to be there with them. He took a stand against evil and joined them in a camp, voluntarily, being imprisoned. And he stood up against that evil around him, providing fun through games, through sport. He was Olympian, so what did he do? He organized tons of sports for the kids to enjoy, and which ended up really entertaining the Japanese guards and creating a great relationship where they were never truly, harmed or put, it's not a concentration camp like we think of during the Holocaust. It's a different experience. Still terrible. Rats eating their toes at night and, horrific, malnourished. Not a pretty picture, but still what he was able to bring was to bring more joy and an ease to their time. So I just want to share that story to lock that in our minds as we continue talking about this passage. Because if you hear nothing else tonight, I want you to hear that we can stand against evil. Because we are sheltered by God's presence. So I want to give you kind of general, what these two chapters are about, then zoom in and look at them a little more specifically, and then do some application. So here, to give you kind of the big picture, John is coming to answer the question of the problem of evil, about suffering. All right, so we see two questions in chapter 6, and I will read them again. Verse 10 says, and you can put this up on the screen, this slide. "How long, Sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood? How long?" the martyrs are asking. And then verse 17, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can withstand it? Who can withstand the evil of this world? The Christians of John's day are being killed by Caesar. All right, so their question, how long and who can stand in the midst of this evil, is so palpable to them. And so they're so ready for John to write this and to answer. And so we see chapter 7 is an interlude where he takes a break from the opening of these seven seals to answer this question. We can see these seven seals as Jesus giving a seven-point sermon. All right? So let's jump in and look at this first part of chapter 7, the horsemen, these first four points of the sermon. The first horseman, it's debated whether this is Jesus or not, if this is Christ riding on the horse. It's debated whether some take that view or some take the view that this is one of, along with the other three, that are issuing destruction and chaos. Perhaps he's one. That first horseman is also bringing destruction. But do you know what's not debated? So that's debated, you know, who the first horseman is. But what's not debated is that there is evil, that the rest of what comes is horrific. All right, so evil is a fact, and it has come. And we can see, I'll just break down a couple of things there, that the, like, being on a horse is depicting battle, right? So this is poetry, so we have to uncode it a little bit. So we can know that they're doing battle, these horsemen. They're up against something. They're up against us. So the red horse is representing war. This is evil between people. This is a social issue. This is people abusing their power. This is people silencing the already oppressed. This is people being unfair and unjust, creating violence with one another. The black horse, this is famine. This is ecological. This is evil in our world, like literally earthquakes, famine, hurricanes. We see this today. This is not so far from our life. And the pale horse is sickness unto death. This is plague. This is pandemic. This is biological. They're physical evil. This is why we're in Revelation. We have these questions too. How long is this going to last? How can we stand in it? How can we stand against the evil? So the rest of chapter 6 is about the day of the Lord coming. So chapter 6 is asked, who can stand in this world of evil? And the answer is, Christians can stand. We can stand. Let me read you a Peterson quote. This is Eugene Peterson. He says, we're protected from the God-separating effects of evil, even as we experience the suffering caused by evil. So, we are going to have suffering, right? It exists. Nowhere in the Bible is it going to answer the question, why does this evil exist? Why is there evil with a good God, right? The Bible is not answering that. This is not answering that. Like, where did this evil come from and why is it happening? But instead, it is asking us, telling us how we can handle it, that God is with us in it. And so we are protected not from the evil, but we are protected from the separation from God. We are protected from the God-separating effects of evil, even as we experience the suffering caused by evil. Even as we experience the suffering of evil we are not separated from God, that God has given us his sheltering presence. We see the answer of a little bit of this problem of evil, and that evil is contained here. It's contained in chapter 6. It's contained. We see that God is above it. All right, we see that the faithful. I'm going to break down two things. We see the faithful, the martyrs. They are in the temple, in the heavenly temple, and they speak directly to God, saying, "How long?" And we see everyone else hiding in the caves, speaking to the mountains, "Come down on me." And so we can see here that with God, we can stand before him and speak to him directly, that there's an intimacy, there's a connection, that even in the midst of suffering, we can be with him. We can speak to him. We can ask, "How long?" So chapter 7 then answers this question of who is able to stand, that Christians can stand against evil because they are sheltered by God's presence. Do you know who else can stand? The angels. The angels are standing. Just side note, really fun, right? They're standing there. They're not bothered. They're not unnerved. They see all this chaos and destruction happening, and they stand. And the great multitude, they stand before the throne. Ian explained last week how John does this thing where he says he hears, like, what's going on, and then he turns around and he sees it. Well, so he's done that again here when he talks about the multitude. He says he hears 144,000, and he names the tribes. But then he turns around and he sees a multitude that is countless, that is every tribe, nation, language, and people. This is all people he sees. No, nobody is excluded. And so we see those who have been followed faithful obedience, who've had faithful obedience standing before God in the midst of suffering. So what's God's role? Where's God been in this? We see he offers protection and peace. In verse 3 of chapter 7, we see protection through the seal. The angel said, "Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God." We see the chapters connected. They're meant to be together with this language of seals. They are sealed here. Just like, you know, of course, this is to remind us of the Passover, and I think Ian even last week reminded of this, that the seal before them is to keep them safe as destruction comes, that it would pass over them, that it would keep them safe. God is offering protection. And he's bringing peace. Let me read first again that last part of chapter 7, verses 15 and 17. "Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them in his presence. Never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." This phrase, "shelter in his presence," it can literally mean that he's pitched his tent over you. Just like enjoy that for a second. You close your eyes and just like imagine that covering. He's pitched his tent over you. He's keeping the destruction out. None of it can enter. He is over and under and behind and before. We can stand against evil because we are sheltered in God's presence. We are protected. We are His. We belong. He has sealed us. So I want to jump into some application, and I just want to share that as I was reading this, the question that really lingered for me was, how do we stand against evil? And this passage doesn't like directly answer this, so take this for what it is. But I do think we can get clarity as we look at the martyrs. Okay, the ones who are standing before God. Right? They face trouble unto death. Obedience unto death. So we know that it's possible that we can stand in this evil. Okay, this evil right now, today, we can stand. And actually, before I like share more, I want to ask the question, and I want you to consider and like try and think of an answer. What evil is troubling you? What evil of today is troubling you? I want you to have something that to kind of lock in your mind as I go forward. What is the evil troubling you? Whatever it is, we can stand against it. Because we have God sheltering us. This is not too big for Him. It is not above Him. We know that we can stand because the martyrs stood. So I think the how do we stand? There's two parts. I think we stand with faithful obedience. And that is broken down to two parts, belief and posture. We need to know the ways of Christ. We need to know what He's about, the beliefs that we're supposed to be following, that we're supposed to be faithfully obeying, right? That He's against evil. God has the last word on injustice. I love this picture of this language of standing, right? It's so active. In our culture, we say to be an upstander, to stand up for what you believe, right? This is an active, engaged, involved. This passage speaks so much to me because I know I'm so tempted to over-spiritualize that God is so big that I over-spiritualize it to the point of letting myself off the hook for not participating and not working against evil. We're not to over-spiritualize it to the point of excusing a lack of participation against the evil that is troubling us. We see from the martyrs that it takes grit, it takes resolve, it takes this faithfulness. My dad has this phrase, stick-to-itiveness, that you must have. Or is that a Susan word?
Oh, I've never really said it,
yeah. All right, a stick-to-itiveness, to stick to what you believe, even when it's the unpopular opinion, even if it will bring harm to you, if it will lead you to death. In this Western world, we don't often experience like a physical death, but we experience an emotional one, right? We experience these pains that feel like a death, losing loved ones. There's so many other ways we feel that internal death. But we can stick up. We can stand up for this evil because we are sheltered by God's presence. But you know, it's not just belief. It's posture. Because if you don't have posture, you're going to be the other person that you disagree with that's really a jerk about what they believe. Right? We all know the activist who's super condescending. or the activists or person who, woe is me, like I'm this, everybody's against me, and they think that they are the martyr. So imposter, I think that we need to never assume that we're the martyr. In evil, we are to never assume we're the martyr. That is only God to claim and call us. And for posture, just like belief, we need to know the ways of Christ. That he did it in love and peace. We have to assume that resistance will come when we stand against evil, but that we will stand with love and peace. And to not assume you're the martyr means staying focused on justice, staying focused on standing with God and where you are with God in this rather than anybody else. And you can't even focus too much on yourself, really, because then that's when you become the martyr sometimes. But just stay focused on Christ, on the cause that you are working with him on. Faithful obedience is standing with God. To know the ways of Christ, to follow Jesus' example, that he stood against evil by riding on a donkey, dying on a cross, and being the slain lamb. He did it with peace and love. So in concluding, I want to share an example of standing against evil. Who loves Anne of Green Gables? Show of hands, anybody? Yes, James! Thank you, male representation! no shame. All right, is anybody following Anne with an E? Okay, it's a series on Netflix that's like loosely following, and that's really what I'm gonna share. So it's the same characters, Anne and Gilbert. But they're very different. They're facing a lot of the modern day issues. We see Anne, who's the fiery activist, writing inflammatory articles in the newspaper and leading a protest about censorship. And then we see Gilbert, who's participating and doing life. In the show, it's different than the books. In the show, he's working on a ship, and he befriends a black man from Trinidad. In a time, this is like the late 1800s, all right? And he befriends Sebastian to the point where they become like brothers. Gilbert has lost all his family, and so he welcomes Sebastian back home with him. And when people get frustrated and give them the eye, he takes a step further and he takes his family's farm, like property deed, and gets Sebastian's name on it. This is the early 1800s. I mean, late 1800s. I mean, sorry, this isn't real, but I'm still so moved by it, right? So how will you stand against evil? Will you be an Anne? And some of us are called to do that big work. Use our loud voice. But I think so many of us are scared by that. And so remember, you can be a Gilbert. You can be, do it just by befriending, welcoming, inviting, stepping into those relationships. What evil is God asking you to stand against? Stand against, to get involved with, to be engaged. I have a challenge for you. I want you every day this week to ask God. Ask God what the evil is that he's asking you to stand against. It's probably that evil that is troubling you, that maybe you named earlier. But if you're unsure, to ask, just start with the question, God, what evil are you calling me to stand against? Listen. See what he says and take a stand. Remember, we can stand against evil because we are sheltered in God's presence.
To find out more about Redemption Church, visit redemptionbristol.org.